MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Russ White.
Here's Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and MSU Secretary to the Board of Trustees Bill Beekman with Venny Gore, Vice President for Auxiliary Enterprises at MSU.
Well, it's a pleasure to welcome you to our program today, and I'm really pleased to have Bill Beekman, who is Vice President and Secretary of the Board, pinch hitting for Mark Hollis. It's a busy time, the end of July, early August, and we've got Bill with us. He's promised to be as funny as Mark Hollis, so we're going to be in good shape. But most importantly, we're pleased to have Venny Gore, Vice President of Michigan State, who, when you touch Michigan State, you've often touched the enterprise that's under Venny Gore, from residential housing to the bookstores to concessions, whatever. And so, Venny, it's really a pleasure to have you and to talk a bit about residential and hospitality services in general, but also some of the innovation that you've been doing within those structures.
Since you've been here, we've done some just tremendous work renovating some of our residence halls, and particularly the cafeterias, and many of them have a unique theme. So in Case Hall, there's a neat Midwestern Michigan foods theme. In Shaw Hall, you've got a really spectacular pizza oven. Are there unique food things that make Landon Hall interesting?
Well, to make Landon Hall, there's a signature salad location in the front. Landon Hall was our first hall that we partnered with the student organic farm. And we use many of the greens that come out of the farm. And so what we wanted to do is continue on that theme of having local organic produce in Landon. So the center feature, which is the gardens, is what it's called, we'll have that. And so there'll be a salad bar, and then we'll do some signature salads along with our soup well. So many of our students who eat in Landon or in the faculty members, that's the one thing they come back for every day.
When you mentioned the student organic farm, one of the things, and I remember when your predecessor retired and we were posting for the position that you now hold, I remember saying to the president that this was a very unique position because it's one that touches so many aspects of the university that people really may not appreciate, the organic farm being one. Since you've come to Michigan State, what have been the more interesting observations you've made? What are the kinds of things that people may not appreciate that your unit is involved in?
Well, I think one of the things about our unit, which we tend to be on the service side of the institution, but one of the things that I really appreciate about the institution is the low barrier of collaboration. We do a lot of research with academic units. So with the College of Ag and Natural Resources, we've been doing work at the Seward Organic Farm. We're doing work with the Animal Science Group on tracing meat. So it'll be raised on the farm, then processed up north, and then brought back to MSU to be sold through our food stores. And the idea is food safety, and so how to be able to track when things are grown, processed, and back into. So there's been a lot of opportunities to do that, which is completely unique for Michigan State.
So what does the word neighborhood mean to you?
Well, neighborhood, it really is about, it's a couple things. One is a geographic location. If one was to sort of take a look at our campus, we're about 2,500 acres on the center part of campus. And each one of our residence halls are geographically located, so in a neighborhood. But it also has an opportunity of having diversity both in academic educational opportunities. So many of our neighborhoods have a residential education component with an academic unit. We also have diversity of people. And our student population represents 160 countries across the world. So they get a very urban experience within their neighborhood. And each one of these neighborhoods are unique. So West Circle is unique from east side of campus or from the Brody campus. So it's one of the few times I think our students will be exposed to a wide diversity of people and thought in this location. And it helps make the university feel small in this large place.
When you think about the campus, because you're constantly doing long-range planning, And you think about the residence hall network, the system, 5 years from now, 10 years ago, what do you think it would look like in the way you dream about it?
If I was to dream about it, what I'd see is this continuum of experiences for our students. So a student comes in as a freshman, and they have a high-intense experience with 100 of their closest friends. And there's a lot of programming. And as the students mature, they'll want different types of living experiences. And what we want to do is offer a different type of living experience for the students as they mature, which then helps them become an engaged student. One of the things that is, as I look at what's going to be successful skills for a 21st century student is the ability to innovate and constantly innovate, the ability to get along with a wide, diverse group of people, the ability to master information technology, and the ability to be flexible in continuous learning. So if I sort of think about that in the context of our residential campus, we want to be able to provide a lot of different experiences so that students can do undergraduate research in a building, they can have seminar classes, they can learn from a lot of different other folks who come here from the 160 countries around the world.
As you think about the issue of food, you know, you serve a lot of meals to people on and off campus, faculty, staff, visitors, lots of people who now engage in eating as part of Michigan State. You buy a lot of food. We've talked a bit about organic food. What are the things that that worry you the most about things like the safety of the food supply as a big consumer of food products?
Oh, there's a couple of things. I think one of the things that we serve 45,000 meals a day, including our combo exchange. And it takes three suppliers to provide lettuce every day for us to be able to do that. And I worry about climate change. I worry about commodity prices, the impact that it has on pricing for our students and to keep it affordable. I worry about that. I also, you know, I worry about as we're seeing more and more students who are coming with severe dietary needs, and to be able to customize a food delivery system when you're doing it for that many people over time and to meet all the needs. So I worry about that. And so as Bill mentioned earlier, what we've done is created these destination locations. And within each one of those destination locations, we have the ability to customize for students who have celiac disease or they're gluten-free. And our chefs, and this has been one of the major changes that we've made in the last 7 years, is we've gone from a production format, which would be what you would have thought about college dining 25 years ago, to much more cook to flow with chefs. And so many of our chefs are able to customize for our students any wide range of needs to be able to meet their needs on any given day. So that's one of the other things. And we hired a dietitian to work specifically with various different students who have certain dietary needs, which has also been something that's been very forward-thinking, because we're one of the few universities that have that combination between our, because we procure roughly about $30 million of food a year, and we do it through our food stores. We're able to really customize that as we move forward to meet the ever-changing demands.
Including racial, ethnic, religious?
Oh, absolutely. So we have a wide range. At Shaw, for an example, our chef Cruz went to China, and he spent 10 days visiting with a lot of the different chefs from around China and was able to bring back the recipes and so that we could customize for our Chinese student population. We have a chef in East right now who's really, really good at good ethnic food out of Detroit. And so you'll start to see some of that happening. We have a chef that's at the stateroom, Rajiv, who we use in the residence halls, who brings from India. So we try to get a whole compromise of chefs. But the other important part of this is that we sent our chefs out to various parts of the country because we want to see what food is like in other places. So Chef Kurt Kawatowski was one of the three chefs in the country in universities that got a CIA award, Culinary Institute of America award. So he studied for a year at the Culinary Institute. And so he's bringing all that knowledge back for us.
So the purpose is really to have high quality, lots of choices, but also in anyone, even though you might not live in that neighborhood, you can go to that neighborhood if you want to choose that cuisine or kosher or whatever the choices may be that fit your needs the best.
Absolutely. The other purpose that we really strive for is creating a sense of third place so that it became a place for the community to come together. And I think that's what you begin to see now. And in Brody, for an example, because it's easy to park, that you'll see neighbors and families come here, and it creates this sort of sense of community. And what's important for our students is it gives that multi-generational understanding of what it means to be part of an MSU. And so that's one of the things that was another thing that we were striving to achieve with our dining plan, is we wanted faculty members to bring their students there so they could have conversations or meet with folks, and that's important for students to see that interaction.
And students who leave the residence hall system in terms of housing often stay connected through food?
Often through food. We probably, the statistic that we used 7 years ago, each time you walk into a dining, you use an access. And so we sold roughly about 30,000 of those access 7 years ago. Last year, we sold 300,000 of those accesses. And many of our students who are moving off campus buy off-campus meal plans. We just recently did some research, and 20% of the off-campus students are coming back into the neighborhoods to use the engagement centers. And that was the idea, is that you may leave your neighborhood, but you can always come back. And Provost Hewitt was really strong about making sure that became an emphasis, that it wasn't just about the people who lived there, but it was about the whole community.
The neighborhoods not only have these programs that are academic, the Hive, but also have services for all students, health services, advising services, career,
tutoring, math,
chemistry. So right. There, and that the phrase within the neighborhood is called an engagement center.
Right. And the engagement center is in that in terms of this broad sense of, and philosophically, it's all about having engaged students. So the more students are engaged in their academic experience, the more that they will take away from that, and then they become a broader citizen. So, and that's the value add of a Michigan State education, is that it's more than just going to the class or living in a residence hall, but it's being engaged into the student experience and the academic experience. And we'll see a number of our students who come out of that, who get involved in a number of different groups, study abroad or whatever. We have salsa dance and music performances by music students. So everyone gets an opportunity to participate in that.
So we're now, you're a parent of a college age student.
Yes.
Bill has a couple on their way.
Getting closer.
Yeah. So he'll be looking at colleges. Mark Hollis has two here. Mm-hmm. D'Antonio has two here. Izzo has one, with Stephen still moving through the ranks. So let's talk a bit about, as parents, not just coming to Michigan State, but as parents think about this major transition, mm-hmm. of bringing their son or daughter to college. How do you see that from both a residence hall perspective, because you catch them at the moment of that transition, to also as a parent of a college-age student who you've had to drop off and sort of nurture through? Mm-hmm. So what advice or comments could you make about that transition?
Well, I think one of the things about it is that, I would say our generation, is the baby boomers here who have kids, we've been active in their life since they were young. It's hard to turn it off. You know, when you drop them off on that August day, and it's just hard to turn it off. And And there's a couple of things that you should be prepared for. One is not to hug and kiss your kid in front of their new roommate, because that won't go over very well.
I've seen this happen more and more often, right?
Yes. Yeah, that doesn't happen. Yeah. And get your good cry in before you drop them off. You know, you got to get all that. But the other part is that where the value of a parent, and I've in my own experience, and I've seen this, is they need you to listen. College is about really learning how to make decisions for oneself and becoming independent. And it's resisting trying to fix their experience, because they're going to have some experiences that would challenge them. They're going to have a roommate who they thought they were going to get along with, they're not going to get along with. And some are lucky that they do have really good roommates. They're probably about some point in October, they're going to realize that college is in high school again, and there wasn't someone there telling them to do their homework, and now that first paper's due or the test is due, and they didn't do as well as they thought they should have done, and they have to learn it. And you have to sort of resist trying to fix it for them, because it's all about the independence. And they will use other things to deflect their stress. Like, they'll tell you that the food sucks. And we all know that it doesn't, but it's just how it's the stress that they're feeling. So as parents, it's just good to be a good listening person. And I think what you'll see is what we see is over the 4 years, you'll see this change in this person. And you'll be quite proud of them.
And as parents here, I mean, there's also on the other side a pretty open door for people to call and say, you know, I'm concerned about.
Yes. And we have our email, and we feel it. We actually encourage you to call, because there are times in which, you know, you're concerned, and we're here, and we're here to help. And there's a collective 15,000 people here are available to help your student be successful. And that's our goal, is to help them persist, to retain, and have academic success.
It's kind of like a giant acrobatic act. We try and provide as huge a safety net as possible, but we try and let people go through the flips and turns of life. And when something gets missed, we're there to try and catch it, but to encourage folks to try that on their own at first.
Right. And we have these parameters that we want people to take a little risk and learn a little bit how to find their boundaries and find themselves. And our students do that. I mean, I think if you look at a Michigan State student, when they leave here, they leave here with a lot of sense of confidence and sense of responsibility, and they're given a lot of opportunities. And we have the safety nets, and we'll step in when we need it, but we'll allow them sort of structurally have a little opportunity to take a little risk, maybe fall a little bit down, but pick them back up. And that's part of the engagement center, and that's part of the staff that's around. And that's why we want students to be engaged.
So within the next month, we'll have 17,000 students coming to live on our campus, and as many more in the greater East Lansing community. For those parents or students who might be looking for maybe with a first-time student, words of wisdom, pearls of wisdom from the person most responsible for the residence halls and moving in and coming to campus, what advice might you give our students?
So my first advice I would give a new student come in is, don't bring everything. We see families at times come with a U-Haul truck into this 150-square-foot space with a bunch of stuff. And I know when my daughter moved in, she had to have everything until she realized her closet wasn't big enough. So, you know, so that would be one of the things. I think the other thing, too, is that what I've witnessed over the years is that this is the family experience. It's for mom and dad and the kids as they take
grandma, grandpa,
everyone,
your
brothers and sisters, everyone comes. And it's a welcoming day, and we welcome you to our campus and be part of the Spartan family. And we encourage you to bring everybody there, because it is a big experience for the whole family, especially for the first-time child going to college. It's a really a big thing. And so come, bring, and enjoy.
Well, and one of the interesting things that wasn't available, I remember when I moved in, brought the box up to the door, opened the door, and you met your roommate. now with technology as it is, you can meet your roommate online or through a mechanism we've created and actually engage in a little bit of planning about I'm going to bring the TV and you're going to bring this and so on.
Yes, Facebook's been wonderful for that because it allows for roommates who haven't met each other to connect and to figure out what they want to bring. And then each building has a Facebook page. So not only do you get to meet your roommate, but you get to meet your floor mates through Facebook. And we often see a lot of our students meet each other during AOP. And so they start this relationship over the two-day period.
So finally, let me sort of close by thinking about a number of people experience your domain by coming to lots of events because you're the food supplier for a number of arena events, but not directly because you also contract with lots of people. How has that changed over time in terms of you know, what I would call the public events?
Yeah. I think one of the things that you've seen and what we'll start to see over the next several years is much more specialty food at stadiums. So if you go to, right, we do concessions at Spartan Stadium, at the Breslin, over at Cobesville. And what we're beginning to see is much more specialty foods beyond just hot dogs and chips and nachos. So we'll start seeing some of that coming to Spartan Stadium and the Breslin Center over the next, 3 to 5 years. I think this will be the natural growth. The other natural growth that you start to see is much more of the fan experience, that fans want to be really engaged in the game and in the whole atmosphere of the sporting event. And food plays a big part of that. And so what we're focusing on is what's that fan experience from tailgating to coming into the game to sitting down, cheering on the Spartans, and then leaving.
Well, Vinny, thanks for joining us on the program. I think we've had a wide-ranging discussion. Bill, do you have a last question or last comment?
Your scope of responsibility is quite extraordinary, from the tennis facility to the golf course to the concessions, obviously the residence halls, and it's just such a critical component of what makes us a great university. So thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
That was Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and MSU Secretary to the Board of Trustees Bill Beekman talking with MSU's Vice President for Auxiliary Enterprises, Venny Gore. To hear their conversation again, please visit SpartanPodcast.com.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman for the MSU Alumni Association. You know, we live in a time where people just don't join things anymore. So why are so many Spartans joining the MSU Alumni Association? Well, perhaps it's our world-class alumni enrichment team, constantly stretching Spartan minds and supercharging Spartan careers. Or perhaps it's our Spartan pipeline, which connects you to trusted friends wherever your adventures may take you. The MSU Alumni Association is dedicated to adding Spartan value to your Spartan life. Whatever it is that may be keeping you up at night, we can connect you with a fellow Spartan who can help. We truly live in a world where who you know is just as important as what you know. And joining the MSU Alumni Association can help you build the relationships you need for success on the job and in every corner of your Spartan life. That's why more and more Spartans are joining the MSU Alumni Association. Activate your membership right now at alumni.msu.edu.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Russ White.
Here's Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and MSU Secretary to the Board of Trustees Bill Beekman with Sue Carter, MSU Journalism Professor and now MSU's Faculty Athletic Representative to the Big Ten and NCAA.
My pleasure to welcome Sue Carter to the program. I was trying to think about, Sue, all of the titles I could add to this introduction. Extraordinary faculty member, School of Journalism, leadership in the college, just coming off a stint as the elected head of our faculty governance system, been very active issues of women and sport over a long period of time. I think you were a radio announcer, play-by-play broadcaster, so avid interest in sports. You've had a divinity degree, and now the next sort of part of your career is being our university faculty representative after a long-serving faculty rep. So it ties together sort of all that skill set you have into one package.
Yeah, thanks, President Simon, and thanks for the opportunity to be here.
So I want you to cast back, though, to your more formal classroom experience, media studies, study abroad. When you signed up to study journalism, the world was a very different place.
It certainly was. First of all, in radio, we were using acetate tape to record, magnetic tape, and razor blades to cut. Now, thankfully, we've moved beyond that stage, so I don't have any more cuts on my fingers.
Right.
But that's how much the situation has evolved. So learning the technology, understanding how to apply it, but retaining the ethics of what we do. And parents will ask me, well, isn't journalism dying? Isn't it dead? Because a number of newspapers have morphed or closed. And I say to them, well, there are three aspects to journalism. One is gathering the information. The second is processing or editing it. And the third is distributing it. Now, the first two remain constant. I mean, we use new tools, but those two. We need to be more thoughtful, I think, as a profession and as a nation on how we monetize it. And that's the one that's really changing.
And what about sports journalism?
Oh, boy, has it exploded. It's just wonderful. I teach a sports media class in the fall that is capped at 100, and if I opened it up to more, I think I'd get more. And maybe I should.
We might be able to fill Breslin.
I think so.
You have a reputation for such a great teacher that we would probably have to sort of crowd it in.
Yeah, teaching is performance art sometimes. But We've gone from, in our area, and you may recall, when it was the ABC football game of the week. There was one game on Saturday, and that was it. And now virtually every football game, Division I, probably Division II, can be seen at some place, minimally being streamed. Maximally, it's there live, whether through ESPN, one of the various ESPNs, the broadcast networks, Big Ten Network. So that, what that's done to is that opened up a number of jobs that just didn't exist when I started, these many years ago.
Let's talk a bit about the ethics of all of this. You used that word a little bit earlier about a role of journalists.
Right.
And I think from a university president perspective, maybe from your new role as a faculty rep perspective, the amount of attention paid to sport because it is profitable economically, whether you've set up a website to follow the Spartans, Bill's a follower, or you're doing a column for a newspaper, but your real passion, your real exposure is with your blog. Rules are slightly different, it appears, and so this sort of feeds an obsession about sport. And highlights sport in interesting ways. So, if you were teaching the class, if you could wave your wand and change some things or talk about something, what would it be in media and sport?
You know, I take them back in history, and I take them back 2,500 years when the Olympics, the original Olympics, started, and how there was a desire for sport. And sport comes out of a number of areas. It comes out of religious celebrations, the desire for human competition, comes out of the need to feed, and also war. So there are four components for sport. Roman emperors figured this out. I mean, they knew that bread and circuses was the way to go. And at one level, humans haven't changed. So our desire for sport, and this is where, it makes sense to the students when I take them there, is if we look over the continuum of history, then we understand how critical sport has been in its various manifestations. We just have more means for accessing sport now. But, 100 years ago, a lot of colleges were playing football. How we report on that and understanding that there are, as you point out, President Simon, several levels of media and approach, that makes a difference. But the respectable, that might not be the right word, the mainstream journalists do maintain a level of ethics or should be called on the carpet if they don't. But everybody has a megaphone these days. You know, you and I can set up a blog and we can put out our own information.
And it's really the sorting through that information.
We need to be culturally literate.
And part of it for me, one of my biggest frustrations about the coverage of sport in particular is we have, what, near 800 student athletes here.
Right.
All of whom are engaging in sport for human competition, for self-competition. For all of the intangibles that go with discipline, mental acuity, I mean, all the things that are part of sport that people celebrate and have for a very long period of time. And for me, that's why we do a sports program. It's not for the, it's for the 99%, not the 1%, who may have an outside chance of making their living in sport.
Yeah, more like 0.03%. You're right.
And but the public fascination with sport is on the 0.0%. It's the stories of those individuals, not the stories that are really embedded in the intrinsic value of sport. And I'm not sure how to change that in a media world where there is such competition for the sensational.
It begs the question, do we feed or do we lead? And to the extent that news media is the agenda setter, yeah, we can find that that rower who comes from a state with not much by way of rivers and has learned how to be a brilliant member, you know, as a, either as a coxswain or someone on the crew. So it requires some originality in thinking. But also, I think as a university, we can help promote those stories and say, this is someone you really should be talking to. She's got a great story.
Well, in part, that was the intent of the Big Ten Network. We had already aggregated our media rights. That was done well in advance of the network. And the decision to sell football games, basketball games, to someone to do was already well in place, and for a while the numbers related to it have changed, but the process of aggregation was something that was happening across the country by conferences. So the Big Ten Channel was really designed to show and showcase student athletes, qua student athletes. Across the board, it was designed to find a way to showcase Olympic sports—the euphemism, but all aspects,
non-revenues, we think
all aspects of sport, from covering the Big Ten rowing championship to the golf championship, broadcasting volleyball games. That also give students in broadcast journalism, in communications, a chance to actually do programming with real-life experiences. Lots of things that were around the Big Ten Channel. And I think part of its popularity has been the coverage of those kinds of things. When I talk to alums, they often talk about, they obviously want to see the football games. I mean, that's a given. And they're glad that they're seen locally, as opposed to streaming them in some fashion. But they also like the idea that they can show their sons or daughters soccer and other sports that are not so prominent. So I feel really good in many ways about the channel. It's just hard to sustain in an environment where the bottom line drives so much.
It is. And part of it is what people want to watch. I mean, good storytelling will take people a long way, but people also make their own decisions and choices about what they want to watch. And if it's football and men's basketball, it's hard to add on to that if their personal media budget, their time, is devoted to those two.
Because that's where the advertising money goes.
I
mean, so it's a really interesting dynamic. I think the channel has proven to be successful.
Very much so.
With this formula. Originally, we had some grandiose idea about how much academic programming people yeah, would want to watch.
That has slipped, and I understand, but it's a little disappointing.
But it's also a bit slipped about our capacity to be creative about academic programming. Mm-hmm. I mean, because you know, doing a program around somebody watching your symphony orchestra play is something that doesn't seem to sell very well. However, the documentary about marching bands did very, very well. Mm-hmm. Or the program about what it took to be a student in that band, in that orchestra, that sold pretty well because it gave an insight into the student experience.
That's good storytelling.
Yeah, but it's just simply putting up a camera and broadcasting something. You know, we sort of learned a bit along the way. So the question is, can we be better storytellers?
Well, I think that has been, in some ways, an avenue of accessibility to those programs for folks. So you can turn on the Big Ten Network and you can see the real interesting storytelling they do around men's basketball with the Journey program. But then they've taken off from that, and so you can see interesting storytelling about a volleyball player or a track athlete, and you might not naturally think, "Gee, I want to watch a volleyball game on TV." But once the story draws you in, it opens you to the various different sports, and I think we have been successful in trying to sort of create that wedge into people's understanding that may broaden horizons beyond football and men's basketball specifically.
And the World Cup, all of the enthusiasm and all of the media attention, I think will redound in a positive way for soccer programs in this country at all levels.
Right. So, because soccer is now something the Big Ten is covering more regularly, baseball games, softball games, the golf tournament.
And as a parent of three kids, despite having 400 or 500 channels to choose from, sometimes your choices for family programming are something created by Disney or you can turn to sports, which teaches ethics and values and hard work, and so it's oftentimes that I'll just sort of, if I'm going to turn something on, I'll turn on the Big Ten channel, and you sort of never know what's showing, but it's always something fun to watch.
Just shifting gears a bit to a little bit more contemporary topic, you've been a part of COIA, which is a national group of faculty.
Coalition on Intercollegiate Athletics.
Mm-hmm. Concerned about the role of sport, lots of issues about faculty role in the governance of sport. And now you're the faculty rep. So as you think about this new assignment and the governance changes and all the things that you're going to be getting yourself into, sort of what did you learn from the COIA experience that you think is very valuable? What have you learned from being an avid sportswoman yourself in varieties of capacities, from the broadcast booth to the participation in ways that are still very, very active? And now as you've sort of been beginning to learn about this role,
I think, among other things, what I have come to appreciate is how critical the role of faculty can be in intercollegiate athletics. And to some extent, faculty vacated or stepped away from the role, I believe. But if I look at the principal statement for both the NCAA and the Big Ten, the mission statement, if you will, it really does put academics and the student-athlete above athletics itself. And because faculty have a role very tightly tied to academics from curriculum on through, there are positions I think the faculty can legitimately take, raising questions and in specifics, for example, of how many missed class days should there be in a semester, how long before the team can depart for, what is the departure time prior to the event itself. So there's some specifics along that, but also the larger issues with regard to graduation, to the student who maybe completes his or her eligibility but hasn't graduated. So those issues are valid for COIA and also for faculty athletic reps. And I note that the term is faculty athletic representative, because that means it's not just athletic representative to the Big Ten or to NCAA. Right. It's the faculty representative. Mm-hmm. So the faculty have a voice in this, and I hope to continue and expand that megaphone, if you will, that I see has been very valuable at Michigan State and should be.
So for those folks that don't know what a faculty athletic representative does, What's the nutshell?
After 1 month.
I'm starting to figure that one out. Well, a representative to both the Big Ten and to the NCAA. In governance situations, and I'll go to the Big Ten first, there are three principal groups who have a voice in governance: the presidents and chancellors, the athletics directors, and the faculty athletic reps. So again, these members of these groups are critical in helping set term and tone for what happens. As institutional responsibility has moved more to the forefront, so too has the role of presidents and chancellors, and understandably so, because when the buck has to stop, it's at your doorstep, President Simon, and they don't necessarily come to find me. So that person then represents and serves on committees and councils. Could be dealing with athletics, with budget, with health, as we see the issue of concussions being raised more at the collegiate and high school and middle school level. So that's how the faculty athletic representative operates externally. But there's also an in-reach as well, and that's reporting back and engaging with the faculty and being available to comment, to participate.
I want Michigan State, as we move forward with Sue in this role, to be, you know, not just really good, but one of the leaders nationally in closing that conversation gap among coaches, student athletes, and the system. And I think Mark Hollis is providing really great leadership for the department. He's committed to this. And with Sue in this new role, we're really excited about even getting stronger and stronger and being a definer of best practice.
And I think someone else is really critical in that mix, and that's the football coach, Mark D'Antonio.
Yeah.
He asked several months ago when my appointment was made if we could have a visit, and I said I'd be honored. And I was very impressed with his concern about and his care for the students who are under his command as football coach.
His family.
Yeah, his it family. Is. It is. And he really carries that through. I was quite taken with that.
I mean, I think I think Mark Hollis's leadership to set a stage for the expectations of people that this isn't about simply the mechanics. It's right. About really being a teacher of young men and women in a way that they would feel proud to leave here as a part of the Spartan family. It's going to be great fun to have you around. We'll probably do another interview after a year anniversary, and you've really gotten your feet wet in all this role.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here. Well, my father once said, that I couldn't keep a job, but I'm very fortunate to be able to get a lot of different ones.
Yeah. Well, and boy, if there was a time to be involved in athletics and the discussions about the future of intercollegiate athletics, you live in interesting times.
Thanks very much.
Thanks so much.
That was Michigan State University President Luana K. Simon and MSU Secretary to the Board of Trustees Bill Beekman talking with Sue Carter, MSU Journalism Professor and now MSU's Faculty Athletic Representative to the Big Ten and NCAA. To hear their conversation again, please visit SpartanPodcast.com.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
Hi, it's Scott Westerman for the MSU Alumni Association. How many times have you been wearing your Spartan apparel in an airport and a voice in the crowd shouts, "Go Green"? Well, that's happened to me in Beijing, Osaka, Kuala Lumpur, and Mumbai, and even in unlikely places like Ann Arbor and Columbus. There's a special bond we Spartans share, and that's at the foundation of everything we do at the MSU Alumni Association. As the world's largest organization of Spartans helping Spartans, MSUAA truly is your personal network for life. From the moment you join, you've added thousands of fellow Spartans to your personal network, people who will pick up the phone and lend a hand, just because you share Michigan State in common. That's the ethic that makes Spartans leaders, lifesavers, and world changers. And that's exactly what you'll find when you become an active member of the MSU Alumni Association. If you share this Spartan spirit, join us at alumni.msu.edu.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
I'm Russ White for the MSU Department of Radiology and MSU Health Team. Mary Thiel is a physical therapist and manager of MSU's Rehabilitation Medicine Clinic.
We are ancillary services to physician services. So there's physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy and psychology services, as well as lymphedema treatment. Lymphedema is swelling in the interstitial tissues. The program began as out of need for treatment of women in particular, status post breast surgery, mastectomies, lumpectomies, and lymph node removal, and they develop swelling in an extremity or in their chest or elsewhere. And it's a program that combines manual lymph drainage, so it's a type of a massage, along with teaching bandaging and fitting a custom compression garment. And it's fairly significant, the work that they do. It's expanded to where not only are they treating post-mastectomy, but any sort of swelling, whether it be post-operative, bilateral low extremity swelling because of complex chronic conditions. It's really quite a service to mid-Michigan and to the immediate community as well. The results are short of miraculous.
It's all about teamwork at the MSU Rehabilitation Clinic and the MSU Health Team.
We have an excellent relationship with MSU Sports Medicine, as well as the rest of the MSU Health Team. And we get anything from sports injuries to neurological disorders, persons with injury, whether it's central or peripheral, and we try and tailor that specific rehabilitation to that person's needs. So we have therapists who have niches. So we have therapists who specialize in sports medicine, post-operative care. We have therapists who specialize in manual skills, so spine, and we have specialists who work more with rehabilitation type traditional neurological insults, Parkinson's, any sort of dystrophy. So it's quite an eclectic environment, which makes it fun and interesting for everyone. And I think the different patient populations kind of inspire one another. Our occupational therapists and our neuropsychologists, they have developed a program for cognitive retraining, which is especially relevant with the more head injuries that we're seeing, more concussions we're seeing in athletes, the persons coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, trying to treat these intermediate brain injury issues where they might be diagnosed with a concussive disorder, but they're not getting treatment. They're healing, so their pain is gone, but when they get into an area where they need to focus their attention, they're unable to do so. And they've developed a program in order to retrain those processing functions. It's really, again, another fascinating aspect of this practice that we're a part of. So we get inspiration from each other, whether we're specialists in neurology or we're specialists in spine or we're specialists in orthopedic. We can draw from one another to have optimal outcomes. In terms of our larger department, what's wonderful about it is there's such a good relationship with sports medicine, with radiology, with nutrition, and with rehab that we're able to provide better care for our patients because we know that sports medicine physician. We know the radiologist who looked at your X-ray or your MRI. We can refer you for your nutritional needs, and it makes preventative care better. It makes outcomes longer lasting without sounding too kitschy. Kind of our motto is educate, engage, and empower. And we all strongly believe in that we want the patient to take an active role in their care. And once we can educate them and show them the techniques to improve themselves, they're now empowered to go ahead and have better health. So it's a great relationship. It's wonderful to work with all these professionals.
MSU's Mary Thiel explains the difference between physical therapy and occupational therapy.
Physical therapy is more what we call gross motor skills, so your larger movement. So, for example, we'll take a runner. They come in with knee pain. So we take a look at their strength, their range of motion, some special tests, how their core is, then put them on the treadmill. How are you running? Can you run? What are their asymmetries between right and left sides? How they're loading through as they're jogging or running? And then divvy that out into a program that's tailored to that client's needs, and then continue to reevaluate so that they can achieve their goals. Occupational therapy usually deals with a little bit more fine motor skills. It's not just hands. Usually it is some upper extremity stuff, but in addition to upper extremity treatment, hands, our occupational therapist, like I said, does some cognitive retraining, sensory perception skills and drills, as well as activities of daily living. So if someone's having a difficulty with dressing, or they need to get in and out of a car, or they need energy conservation, they might see our occupational therapist to evaluate those needs as well.
Mary Thiel says the mission of the MSU Rehabilitation Clinic is to help its patients to not just survive, but to thrive.
Our mission is to enhance the health of the community, to help them rebound after any sort of injury, whether it's cognitive or more musculoskeletal. One of our neuropsychologists like to say it's not just about surviving, it's about thriving, and trying to get individuals to value what they're doing and how they're moving through space so they can get to that point where they're not just surviving, but thriving. And that's what goes on here. It's a very upbeat environment. There is a lot of energy, a lot of enthusiasm for what we do. We like establishing that relationship with patients. We get better outcomes that way as well. So anyone from myself as the clinic manager to our reception area, we like to see and hello and greet people and how are you doing, and like to see that progress. It's not only satisfying for the patient and client, it's truly satisfying for us. We really enjoy recovery and staying healthy.
Please visit the MSU Rehabilitation Clinic online at rehab.msu.edu.
This is MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR.
For listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. To hear this show again, please click on the local tab at WKAR.org and scroll to MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR.